at the dual purposes that this court has recognized for the partial veto. One is to give the governor greater control over the budget bill that he himself drafts and introduces in the legislature, and two is to unbundle omnibus appropriation bills. If that's not convincing to Your Honor, I would submit that the Wisconsin people have understood this debate in 1990 and 2008 after Thompson. I must emphasize that the 1990 amendment was proposed 16 days after this court issued its Thompson decision, in which it said that the partial veto.
Yeah, so maybe what the people of Wisconsin were responding to is not the constitutional text, but our opinion.
Well, I fundamentally disagree with that, because I think if petitioner's view of those amendments was correct, and what they really signaled was a fundamental disagreement with what this court said in Henry, those amendments would have looked nothing like they did. They would have instead looked like one of the menu of amendments that the legislature has rejected over the decades that would have actually created an item veto, a section veto, a reverse complete and workable law test. All of those have been considered by the legislature over the years. And so if that's what the people intended after Thompson, they would have approved that kind of amendment. But that is not what they approved. Instead, understanding the Thompson decision and where this court had led us, the people essentially said, we are ratifying Henry. We are ratifying the court's decisions that followed from Henry. We are even ratifying Thompson, except for two specific practices that Thompson blessed: the letter veto and the combined sentence veto. And so I agree with, you know, Your Honor may doubt what the people intended in 1930. I may not be able to persuade you to eliminate that doubt, but I don't think we're writing on a blank slate here. I think it is critical that we give effect to the 1990 and 2008 amendments, and let me try it a different way. I think what petitioners are ultimately asking this court to do is privilege the 1930 amendment over the 1990 and 2008 amendments. And I'm simply not aware of any principle of constitutional interpretation that allows this court to essentially pick and choose which pieces of the Constitution it wants to privilege over others. I think each of subsection B and C in Article 5, Section 10 must be respected and must be given effect. And so I think the bottom line is the people spoke in 1990 and 2008 against the backdrop of this court's decisions. Of course it's against the backdrop of this court's decisions. I won't dispute that. But I think what they said was, we think that this distribution of power is the one we want. Are there other distributions of power that we could choose? Of course there are. Of course we could restrict the governor's veto power more. But instead what we're going to do is stick with what this court has always said, and only remove what we think are the two most aggressive uses of that power. And so I think we simply can't turn back the clock now at this point and ignore those expressions of the people's will. I just am not aware of any constitutional interpretive principle that allows us to do this. And I really do think it's not simply a matter of rendering those amendments superfluous, in the sense that, well, if we revisit 1930 and we get it right this time around, well, that's no problem, because that's what the people really intended. It's not even as much about rendering those amendments superfluous as understanding that those were really ratifications of what this court has said over the near century of its consistent decisions.
Counsel, let me just follow up on that with a hypothetical for you, or maybe it's not that hypothetical. Women were granted the vote via constitutional amendment, correct? So do you think that ratified an interpretation of the 14th Amendment that ensures that women have no political rights under the 14th Amendment?
Well, I don't see that as comparable here. Because there's nothing left to infer about, if the issue is do women have the right to vote, clearly the amendment said yes, and there's nothing left to infer about the 14th
Amendment. The inference would be the 14th Amendment says nothing about the right of women to vote.
again, I'm not sure that once the amendment was passed, the subsequent amendment, there's a need to infer anything about the 14th Amendment. I mean, it does, but I don't see those as comparable.
It just by way of analogy and thinking through this, and I see the textual argument you're making, and there's a lot of strength to it, but you know, the counter argument, of course, is, and just to get more abstract for just a minute, suppose you have an amendment that says X. The court interprets it to mean X, Y, and Z, and the people muster the political will to take out the Z. Does that mean that the amendment now means, as a matter of original public meaning, X and Y?
I think it does here, because by using the word part in the way that the legislature did, and again, this is an amendment crafted by the legislature, drafted by the legislature, and passed by two consecutive legislatures, and then ratified, by using the word part, and again, petitioners concede this, I think the legislature does also, that necessarily meant X and Y are still allowed. I think if we intended to disallow X, Y, and Z, again, like I said earlier, I think the amendments would have looked far different. They would have looked X, Y, and Z are not allowed. But I think, again, the basic principle is by saying in approving a bill in part, the governor may not reject individual letters to create new words. I mean, purely as a matter of grammar, that's incoherent if the word part means what the petitioners and the legislature say it does. And I don't think we should lightly ascribe incoherence to the people when they're ratifying constitutional amendments.
But it wouldn't have been incoherent in light of this court's interpretations and decisions, would it?
Sorry, I guess I don't understand. Maybe I'm missing the question. I mean, I think, you know, imagine in those amendments, the word part meant what the petitioners and the legislature say it does. So in the place of part, read in those amendments, in approving an appropriation bill in part, and by part we mean only a part in which the rejected part cannot be a complete workable law, the governor may not create a new word. I mean, those two clauses would not fit together. They would just make no sense.
My question was directed at, I think, something that was brought up earlier, perhaps by a different attorney during this argument, but the point is that perhaps the amendments responded to interpretations by this court of the constitutional text rather than the original meaning that the petitioners would ascribe to it. So in that sense, would it be incoherent?
Well, I still think, I will not dispute that it responded to this court's decisions. I think that's, of course, what it did. The 1990 amendment in particular responded to Thompson. But in responding to Thompson, it baked into that amendment is the very decisions that this court has always made. And I guess my incoherence point is you know, I don't want to overstate it, but I mean, I think it's really a grammatical one. When I want to understand the text, and when I want to understand what part means, I can't ascribe to the word part a definition that would result in an incoherent sentence that simply does not fit together. And I think the only interpretation before this court today of the word part that gives a unified meaning to each usage of the word throughout the constitutional text is the one that this court has always adopted. It's the one that the people approved in ratifying the 1990 and 2008 amendments. It is simply not the ones presented by the legislature and the petitioners.
So in acknowledging that this court's decisions are baked in, I think is the expression you used, are baked into those amendments, what if this court is to determine that prior courts got it wrong?
Your Honor, I don't think that, frankly, I do not think it's any longer within the court's authority to do so. And the reason is because when the people spoke and baked in an assumption that this court got it right, that is a ratification of those prior decisions. And I really don't see any source of authority to ignore those expressions of the people's will. I mean, I think we have to remember that this is an amendment.
How could it be a ratification of this court's decisions if the amendments were responding to the court's decisions, which I think you would probably also acknowledge the people do not have the prerogative to disregard, nor does the legislature, nor does the governor, right?
Well, I think both the legislature and the people have the power to change the Constitution. And so in that sense, of course, everyone has to follow the decisions that the Supreme Court makes if they're constitutional decisions. But the people can change the Constitution through their amendment authority. That's what Article 12 says. And so in responding to those decisions, if the people thought this court got it wrong, they could have themselves crafted an amendment that expressly said so and said, you know, we want to transform this partial veto power into something entirely different. We want to turn it into an item veto or a reverse complete and workable law veto. You know, there's a whole menu of things that the people could have chosen. But rather than make one of those alternative choices, they selected a very modest one, which is we are going to incorporate everything this court has done and just bar two specific techniques that follow from it. So I just don't think now that the 1990 and 2008 amendments have been passed, there's no going back. I think the only way to select a new partial veto power is to go through the deliberative Article 12 amendment process. And I'd like to take a minute to talk about why I think that's so important here. I don't think that either alternative that the petitioners have offered is going to be some panacea for either separation of powers concerns or day-to-day governance. I think there are serious problems with both. Yes?
Before you go further down a different path, I just need to clarify something in my mind. We generally think of the legislature being vested with the power of the purse, the ability to legislate. I understood your argument to be that here vesting is not exclusive, it's a shared power because it involves spending in the budget context, right?
I wouldn't put it precisely that way. I would say, as a default matter, yes, the legislative power is vested in the legislature. That is certainly the default principle that applies. However, I think the constitutional text in this circumstance expressly assigns some of that power in the appropriation context to the governor. So I think in this context, the text itself creates the shared power. That's why the default principle does not apply here.
So in this context, the legislature is not endowed with the authority or power of the purse. It's shared.
Well, yes, it shares that power with the governor. I mean, I think, again, we see that through the governor's ability, and again, this is contemporaneous with the 1930 amendment, statutes granting the governor the power to draft budget bills.
What if any limits are there, since a lot of things involve spending money? What limits are there then on the governor legislating?
Well, the constitutional text provides the limits, I think, is the answer to Your Honor's question. It's a power only in the context of being presented with a budget bill from the legislature. Obviously, the governor cannot pass a bill on his own. He needs to receive a bill that the legislature has sent to him. But once he receives that bill, then he gets to use the tools that the Constitution has given him to make the changes based on that power. And I think it's critical to emphasize that that's not the end of the process. The legislature has tools to defend its prerogatives here. Again, this is a shared power. It's checks and balances between the two branches. And so I think the legislature can override the veto. It can keep policy provisions out of its appropriation bills entirely. such that they're not subject to the governor's veto pen at all. Again, it's critical to remember that this partial veto power extends only to appropriation bills and not to pieces of general legislation. So, or the legislature can propose another constitutional amendment to change the governor's veto power. So again, I just want to emphasize it's the legislature is certainly has a primary and defendable role in this process.
So in any appropriation bill, the governor can legislate?
Well, I think he can approve the appropriation bill in whole or in part. And how you characterize the result of his approval in part, whether you call it an affirmative power, a creative power, I mean, I think those are just labels that we're assigning to the end product of what the constitutional text allows the governor to do. I don't know that it really is that analytically helpful to say, well, you know, this is an exercise of legislative power or affirmative, creative power. I really don't know that those have much explanatory power here, given that I think we start with the text and follow where it leads, and again recognize that there are two express limitations that the people have chosen to place on the power, and that's it. So I think those are the limitations, if that answers Your Honor's question.
Yes, thank you. I would like to follow up on an earlier question asked by Justice Ziegler at the start of this hearing. And she asked about what are the arguments being advanced regarding the infirmities of the four partial vetoes here. You've got the school bus, the construction fund, the vaping tax, and the fees on the truck. And there were two responses. You have to change the test under existing law. I take it from a petitioner, and petitioner can correct me if I'm wrong when he's back up to bat, so to speak, that there is an acknowledgement that under existing case law, these vetoes are lawful. But they ask for two things. Number one, a change so that what is left is part of the test, and what is left has to be complete and workable, not just what's passed. And the second thing is that the veto cannot transform policy. That's another way of talking about legislation or prescription rather than proscription, as discussed in some cases. So what's your response to why these four vetoes are lawful and zeroing in on should we be changing the test to what's left is also not complete and workable, and transforming policy is verboten?
Sure. I think to answer Your Honor's question, I don't think any of us dispute that under this court's current case law, and by us I'm referring to the petitioners and the legislature, that under this court's current case law, each of the four vetoes here is lawful. I think everyone agrees with that. And so, again, the only way we can overturn any of these four vetoes is through a decision that I think overrules practically every one of the decisions this court has ever issued and essentially deletes two constitutional amendments. And so that's the only way we get to a invalidation of these four partial vetoes. Now, I'd like to maybe use the four vetoes here to expand on I think one of the last points I wanted to get to, which is if we actually look at the two tests that are proposed here, again, I strongly disagree with the premise that we're at liberty to simply select from a menu of options. I think the people have already made that choice. But in any event, both tests that are proposed here, it's not at all clear to me that these are going to be administrable tests. I think especially this idea that we can examine legislative intent to determine whether the legislature would have passed the bill without the vetoed part, I think that's just an absolute nightmare for this court to get involved in. Consider Governor Walker, 309 partial vetoes during his time in office. Is the judiciary really going to start examining each of those 309 partial vetoes and trying to understand if the legislature would have intended to pass them anyway without the vetoed portions? I cannot even imagine how that would work. It would be, frankly, chaos in the budget process. The governor could not predict which vetoes would stand. The legislature would have no idea either, I don't think. And regulated parties, importantly. I mean, people depend on stability in the budget once it's passed. But I think this test is going to create massive uncertainty, tie up significant portions of the budget bill in litigation every 2 years. I mean, with this new test, if that's adopted, I mean, this court will be called upon again and again and again to resolve how it's applied to individual cases. I suppose the test would be settled, but someone has to apply it to the individual vetoes. And I just don't see how that's workable in any way. And I think the people wisely chose a different system. I mean, that's why the Article 12 amendment process is so critical when considering such a structural issue as this one. I think it's so important that two legislatures and the Wisconsin people have the opportunity to consider this kind of sweeping revision that the petitioners are asking for, consider the strengths and weaknesses, the drawbacks, the trade-offs, all of those, and only then approve such a transformational change. And then I guess what I'd say for the reverse, so again, I mean, we can look at any of the four vetoes here. I have no idea how to evaluate whether the legislature would have passed them anyway. I mean, it's a mystery to me. And in terms of the reverse complete and workable law test, I'm not convinced that would be much more clear than this inquiry into legislative intent. I don't know how it would apply to appropriation amounts. I don't think anyone disputes that writing down appropriations or zeroing them out is in the core of what the governor should be able to accomplish through the partial veto. I don't know. Are those vetoes going to survive? I don't think Xing out $1 million appropriation is a complete and workable law. So I think that's out the door. And ultimately what it would accomplish is the legislature would learn the new test, and what it could do is essentially daisy chain the whole budget together and say each part is contingent on every other part, and so none of them can be excised without the entire bill falling. And I think that's the entire that would undermine the fundamental purpose of the partial veto, which is to allow the governor to pass on individual pieces within an omnibus budget bill. So I think there are real disadvantages to either of the tests the petitioners have proposed here. And again, I will say that when the people spoke in 1930, 1990, and 2008, they made their choice. I think they had a menu of options in front of them. The legislature has had a menu of options in front of it. And they didn't choose a reverse complete and workable law test. They didn't choose a test focused on legislative intent. That would be extremely difficult to administer. They chose the test that we have now, which has the virtues of being clear, predictable, and provides both branches with an adequate opportunity to defend its prerogatives. Look at these four vetoes. We can examine them, any way we want. But I think the bottom line is that they're undoubtedly lawful under this court's current case law. They're undoubtedly lawful under the two amendments that the people ratified. And the only way to invalidate them is to essentially start from scratch and build a whole new partial veto doctrine from the ground up. And I think it's simply too late in the day for this court to do that, given the 1990 and 2008 amendments. that was the expression of the will of the people, and it must be respected. I don't have much more to say unless there are further questions. I'm happy to answer. I guess I could say one part about just add to respond to the legislature's textual argument. I think it rests on a fundamental misunderstanding of what the phrase "shall become law" means throughout Article 5, Section 10. Again, all that means is when a bill is approved by the governor, it acquires the force of law. And it's a mistake to think that the part rejected somehow needs to be a complete and workable law. I think that's a complete misunderstanding of how the test originated. The rejected part simply never becomes law unless it's overridden by the legislature, and so there's no need for a part rejected to stand alone. I think the reading that this court has always given to the word part, again, is uniform throughout Article 5, Section 10, and that's what constitutional interpretation requires. So with that, if there are no other questions.
Thank you. Attorney Essenberg, are you prepared for rebuttal?
I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please begin.
I'd like to return to Justice Hagedorn's example of the 14th Amendment. There are certainly canons of construction that we could use to argue that once the people passed a constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, they were making a judgment that the 14th Amendment did not apply to distinctions based on gender, as courts at the time probably thought it did not. But it would be implausible to make that conclusion or then to subsequently argue that the 14th Amendment can't possibly apply to gender because it would render the amendment granting women the right to vote superfluous. That's simply, that might be an argument that we might make with respect to legislative determinations, but it's simply a fiction when it applies to the passage of people by constitutional amendments. All of this rather odd situation that we have here, where the governor and the legislature play this game to determine what becomes the law of the state of Wisconsin, rides on a definition of the word part. But as we pointed out in our brief, contemporary dictionary definitions of the word part do not compel, in fact, do not even strongly support that construction of the word part. It is one definition, piece or fragment, but the are also definitions that indicate that a part is a coherent and an identifiable subdivision of the whole. And so now we look at the context of the use of the word part, and we find that it is used in conjunction with approval or disapproval. And reassembling and recreating a law is not, in common parlance, approval or disapproval. If we look at the purpose of Article 5, Section 10, we find that the purpose was to respond to the legislature's practice of combining multiple separate legislative initiatives in an omnibus budget bill. This suggests to us that the part that the governor ought to be able to veto are any one of these legislative initiatives that have been combined into an omnibus budget bill. There is nothing in the history of this amendment, absolutely nothing, that would indicate that the people of the state of Wisconsin contemplated enacting a constitutional structure in which the governor and the legislature would play this game that they play every year, every 2 years, rather. And so it's, I think, relatively easy to conclude that the decision was unsound, that this rule that permits this to happen is unsound in principle and certainly wasn't ratified by the people in 1990 and 2008, because once again, there's nothing in the history surrounding those amendments which suggests that they were passing upon this general principle or concluding that we think that the governor can rewrite laws as long as he stays within a single sentence. Mr. Ross suggests that, well, if the people really wanted to change this, they would have passed a different amendment. But just as when the people passed upon an amendment that only gave women the right to vote, the people of the state of Wisconsin in 1990 and 2008 were passing only upon an amendment that was directed to particular abuses. They were not asked any other question, and so their answer to that question cannot be inferred or assumed. I don't think that we can place much weight on legislative acquiescence or the fact that the legislature hasn't set forth a different amendment because of the important separation of power principles involved here. The separation of powers, as this court has recently recognized, is not for the benefit of those who hold the power to protect the people. And so when it comes to enforcing our separation of powers, waiver by the political branches is not an option. And just as the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, did in INS versus Chadha, where they struck down the legislative veto, even though it had been utilized approximately 300 times in our history, that it is the duty and the role of this court to say what the law is.
Let's assume you prevail with regard to the new test that that which has been rejected has to also be complete and workable. What's the remedy is my question. In reading the legislature's brief, it indicates on page 12 that the remedy should not include disturbing the vetoes in this case, but rather be prospective only. What's your opinion or argument with regard to remedy? Are you in accord with the legislature's suggestion, or do you disagree with it?
Well,
Counsel, your time is again it disappeared on you, but please answer Justine Walsh Bradley's question.
I will. Thank you. The under the law as it exists, because the vetoes would be ineffective, and the law originally enacted would become law. We indicated in our brief that because we acknowledge that we're asking for a change, that the court might indicate that these particular vetoes can be sent back to the governor and he can either approve them or exercise a proper veto. Because we are challenging these provisions as an unlawful expenditure of state funds, we do not ask that that there be some type of sunburst treatment of them and any new rule that's adopted be prospective only. We understand, however, that is within the court's prerogative and that the court may choose to do that.
So the answer is you disagree with their proffered remedy. Is that
right? Yeah, we ask for something different.
Okay. Thank you all. And attorneys, thank you very much. I think this worked fairly well, at least from our perspective on this side of the bench, and I hope you found it satisfying as well. I know the next case that we have has similar issues, but the court is going to take a 10-minute break, and then we will be back with you for the second case of the morning. So we are...